Are there such sacred cows? Should there be blanket prohibitions from joking about particular subjects? A related debate that's been brewing among philosophers of humor concerns what's termed comic moralism and comic immoralism. If we accept that some jokes are immoral, what effect does that have on the funniness of a joke? Are morally problematic jokes funnier because of the forbidden fruit effect? Does the fact that something is off limits from us to do or even to talk about make a joke about it much funnier? Or is it the case that immorality spoils the joke? Are we so shocked and put off by the lighthearted treatment of a taboo subject or the expression of a clearly morally problematic view that we're unable to put ourselves in the playful mood necessary for humor? Or could it be that funniness and morality are independent? Is funniness a function of joke structure and not content? Finally, we'll look at professional comedians. Does being on stage at a comedy club change any of the moral considerations? Should we give comedians special moral dispensations, allowing them to say things and joke about things that we cannot in normal conversation? Is the comedy club a special space reserved for the edgiest of speech? Or is it just another venue for discourse which must follow the rules the rest of us have to live by? Would there be value in creating a special space for what would otherwise be thought of as moral transgressions? Are comedians expressions of our cultural id? Or should we think of them as our cultural superego? Should comedians get extra leniency because they're the ones who keep us honest, the few who can speak truth to power? As you see, humor raises many, many ethical issues. "I was only joking" does not end the moral conversation. Indeed, it launches it. Now that we have a basic understanding of the different approaches to moral reasoning, we'll need to consider each question humor raises in detail and see what the arguments on each side are and assess their relative strengths and weaknesses. That will occupy the third section of this course, at the end of which we'll learn how many ethicists it takes to change a light bulb. Okay, 4. A utilitarian to begin calculating whether it would be better to be in the dark or not. A deontologist to argue with the rights-based theorist over whether it was his duty to change it or whether he had the right to choose someone else. And a care-based theorist to say, "Fine, I'll just take care of it again, like I always do." Thanks, Mom.
Lecture 18. Who can tell ethnic jokes?
So, the farmer says to the brother-in-law, "Well, how many chickens can I have?" And the physicist says, "Well, assuming spherical chickens."
Hey, what do you call a bird that's afraid to fly?
Chicken. Hey, how does a chicken wake itself up in the morning?
An alarm clock?
I can't believe you guys are telling jokes like that. My sister married a chicken. It's a member of our family. Unlike you people, we respect chickens for the kind, caring beings that they are. It is beyond my comprehension that you're still telling jokes like this. You are pigs.
What do you call a pig with no legs?
Groundhog.
When we think about humor and ethics, the first topic that jumps to mind is the question of the moral permissibility of telling ethnic jokes. We'll take a broad sense of ethnic joke to include any joke that has as its butt an entire group. It could be people of a geographical background, Irish or Poles. It could be a religious affiliation, jokes about Jews. It could be hair color, blondes. Or it could be occupations, lawyers or dentists. These are jokes in which the humor is based on employing a stereotype of a given group. We all know lots of these jokes. Indeed, it seems like every group has some other group who's the target of their ribbing. University of Texas grads make fun of those from Texas A&M. Minnesotans make fun of North Dakotans. Engineers make fun of physicists. Physicists make fun of mathematicians. Mathematicians make fun of people who can actually get dates. I'm from Maryland. For us, it's our neighbors in West Virginia. How do you know the toothbrush was invented in West Virginia? Because if it had been invented anywhere else, it'd be called a teeth brush. Some people think that joke is funny. Some people think that joke is mean. Some people think that joke is both. Now, the word mean is clearly a morally loaded term. If we say something is mean, then it seems to imply that it's wrong to do. Was it morally problematic to tell that joke? There are three groups of answers. One, universal impermissibility. It's never allowable to tell ethnic jokes. The jokes are themselves problematic and ought never be told. Two, universal permissibility. They're just jokes. There's nothing wrong with telling them anytime, anywhere. Three, limited permissibility. These jokes are sometimes morally allowable. Of course, if you hold this third view, it becomes your responsibility to sketch out what are the conditions that make it okay or not okay to tell a given ethnic joke. We're going to work through the arguments for several versions of each view. We'll work out each of these positions in its strongest version, making the best case for each. If you're looking for a straightforward answer to the question, you've come to the wrong place. This is philosophy. If we actually answered these questions, then philosophers would have to go out and find real jobs. So, let's start with the arguments against the moral permissibility of ever telling any ethnic jokes. The view here is that all of these jokes are ethically off limits. No one should tell them ever. The argument is based on the fact that for these jokes to work, the central architectural feature is the use of a stereotype. What ethnic jokes do is to engage a flattened, dehumanized cartoon character, which is held to be representative of all of the members of that group. Jews are cheap. Irishmen are drunk. Blondes are stupid. Lawyers are dishonest. We paint all members of a large, diverse community with a single brush. We take the group to have only the one or two negative properties, and then we create a situation in which to place them, a situation in which the flaw we attribute to the group leads to an absurdity. We then laugh at the absurdity created by the flaw and thereby make fun of the group for having the flaw. A hiker comes through the woods and finds himself on the bank of a river. He looks upstream, downstream, but can't find a bridge. He spots a blonde across the river and yells over, "Excuse me, can you tell me how to get to the other side of the river?" The blonde looks at him and yells back, "You are on the other side of the river." We laugh at this because the blonde is so stupid that she thinks "other side" is a property and not a relation. That's so silly. It just goes to show how stupid those people are. Sure, that may not have happened, but it might as well have. That's how they are. It's funny because it's true. Okay, maybe not true, but true-ish. Funny, you don't look true-ish. What stereotyping does is to trap members of a group under certain expectations that they may not embody. The stereotype removes the individuality from the individual. That is itself a harm. But it gets worse. These stereotypes aren't new. They pre-exist us in society, and the jokes just further entrench them in our cultural consciousness. By telling and retelling these jokes, we convince people of the truth of the stereotype, even if we claim it's just a joke. Subconsciously, the more we hear it, the more we associate the property with the group and expect it of the individual. This leads to real, not fictional, oppression. When someone of that group is applying for a job, for example, what will immediately come to mind is the stereotype, and that will harm them. It's a harm that they did not earn, and they do not deserve. Notice that this is what we called a utilitarian argument in the last lecture. It takes moral rightness and wrongness to be a function of the consequences of an action. The argument for this view is that the ethnic jokes have the consequence, intended or not, of entrenching a stereotype. And all stereotypes, even positive ones, dehumanize the individual and cause harm. Sometimes it's from the outside, job discrimination, for example, and sometimes from the inside. We internalize the expectations and come to embody them or fret when we don't. It may be a positive stereotype of, say, Asians, for example, that they're smart, especially in the sciences. But of course, not all are. If someone of Asian heritage who's not naturally gifted in analytic tasks is repeatedly subjected to the ethnic jokes, then they'll develop a sense of what's wrong with me that is thoroughly undeserved. These jokes use stereotypes, and stereotypes will, in a myriad of ways, lead to harm in the group stereotyped. Therefore, these jokes should never be told. This view is far from universally accepted. Comedians especially chafe at it. They want complete freedom to joke about anything, anytime. Their view is one of universal acceptability when it comes to the moral permissibility of ethnic jokes. There are three completely different arguments for this universal permissibility of telling ethnic jokes. The first is what we could call the meaninglessness position. It contends that jokes are just jokes. They're fictions, but even more fictional than regular fiction. The point of a joke is that it is knowingly and explicitly absurd. It's not a vehicle for truth. Jokes have no meaning. When we make jokes about a group, no one who isn't a complete moron and bigot believes that everyone in that group has the given property. It's a cartoon character that's employed in the joke, not a real person. Television casting directors get an actor every single week to play a corpse on Law and Order. They don't really kill someone. We know this isn't real. We do not get upset at war movies for waging a real war. We may suspend disbelief for that moment of the artistic act, but we do disbelieve in real life. In the same way, comedians argue, their audiences know these are just jokes. They know these are not meant to be taken seriously as containing propositional content. Give people some credit and lighten up. They're just jokes, and jokes make people laugh but have no lingering consequences. These jokes don't really hurt anyone, but they do bring pleasure. Note that this, again, is a utilitarian argument. Here the contention is that the morally relevant element is the way the joke affects people. When we consider the consequences, however, they're not the negative results that the universal impermissibility camp contend, but rather a big fat zero. The other two arguments in favor of universal permissibility disagree with the meaninglessness view. They agree with the impermissibility advocates that ethnic jokes do have meaning and do have consequences, but they contend on very different grounds that the consequences are actually good. We can call these views the positive political view and the positive sociological view. The positive political view contends that while ethnic jokes perhaps can sometimes be harmful, in the overall balance, they play a crucial role in the organization of society. Jokes are the contributions of comedians, and comedians occupy a special and crucial place in the cultural ecosystem. As humans, we live in society with a power structure. Some people are more powerful, some people are less powerful, and some people are completely powerless. Those who are powerful control both the platforms for public speech and the rules for the content of allowable speech. If the powerful don't want you to say something, you will not say it, or there will be consequences. Because of the distribution of social and political power, there are topics that we don't talk about. There are topics we've been made to feel uncomfortable, even bringing up. Often these topics are disallowed because considering them may threaten the power of those in control. This unchecked power can lead to oppression, bringing real harm to many people. But the one place we often allow this speech is in humor. The clown, the jester, is the only one who can really speak truth to power, who can tell the king what the king does not want to hear. Jokes do have meaning, and oftentimes, the only way we convey these propositions, the only way we enter these essential claims into the public discourse is through comedy. Humor, this line contends, is a social corrective. When things go wrong, we can ridicule them. It's the jokes that really lead us to face what we otherwise would ignore and then take positive action. If we place certain groups or certain sorts of humor morally out of bounds, then we've blunted our most powerful tool for social justice. We may be trying to squelch ethnic humor out of concern for the less powerful, but by limiting our ability to make jokes about them, what we've really done is to take away the weapon that will change the structure of the culture to actually make their lives better. We need to allow comedians and other joke tellers the widest possible latitude, because any constraints on humor will keep humor from being able to play its proper role as a social corrective. Yes, sometimes that corrective may inflict a little collateral damage, but that's a small price to pay for the larger positive impact that humor has in working for justice and against corruption and oppression. It may be true that some Irishmen will be harmed to a small degree by some particular Irish jokes, but the little bit of harm from some given joke is tiny compared with the good that will come from justice on the large scale that results from our being able to discuss the problems associated with the social order that were out of bounds before we started joking about them. Once again, notice that we have a utilitarian argument. There may be some harm caused, but when you add up all the benefits and injuries, all the good well outweighs the bad. This justifies a complete freedom to joke about anything. The final version of the universal permissibility view is the positive sociological view. As its name suggests, it's a favorite of social scientists. All the previous views have been utilitarian in nature, which means that they make their claims about the moral rightness or wrongness based on the consequences of the telling of this sort of joke. But consequences are observable, so to make an accurate argument, you would need data. Rather than appealing to intuitions about what you think happens, look at the world and see what actually happens. A collection of sociologists, anthropologists, and folklorists, including Christy Davis and Elliot Oring, did exactly that. They examined what they termed joke cycles, that is, collections of similar types of joke, light bulb jokes, dead baby jokes, or elephant jokes, and see what factors in society might be influencing the appearance and spreading of these jokes at that time. Jokes are social artifacts. They're made and spread by a culture. Biologist Richard Dawkins, in his groundbreaking book, The Selfish Gene, in the mid-70s, came up with the term meme. Long before the concept became a standard part of internet culture, Dawkins realized that there are thoughts, ideas, behaviors, cognitive elements that could spread through a population in the same way a disease could. We could be infected by an imitation of a way of acting. The Greek term mimesis got shortened to meme to describe this phenomenon. In this way, we can think of jokes as similar to a virus. They pop up and get spread from person to person. We can ask, in the case of a virus, what are the biological factors that make people susceptible to infection, and what are the epidemiological factors that lead to its spreading, and when and how it does. Similarly, we can ask analogous questions about jokes. When do these jokes appear? Why do these jokes appear when they do? Why are they spread the way they do? As I've mentioned in an earlier lecture, what the social scientists found was very interesting and counterintuitive. Ethnic jokes concerning a group do not emerge at the time of peak oppression of that group. When a group is subjected to serious bigotry and discrimination, they do not also hear a lot of jokes about themselves from those who are keeping them down. We don't joke about groups we hate or fear. We oppress them. It turns out the jokes appear about a generation later, once the group has become largely assimilated into the normal cultural life. The social scientists argue that this isn't accidental. These jokes are a social signal. Think about who it is that you joke with the most. You might tell a joke to a stranger every now and again, but usually the people you joke with are your friends and family, those with whom you're closest. Just as it is with personal relationships, so it is too with cultural ones. When the joke cycles about your group begin, what it means, so the social scientists contend, is that you've been welcomed into the in-group, one of the cool kids. You've earned your hyphen. When we joke about you, you know we think of you as real Americans, but you're Americans who are also allowed to keep your subgroup identification. You are an Italian American, an Irish American, a Polish American. The hyphen between your group and American is special. You are us, but a kind of us that's different, but still within the boundaries of us. So, instead of being offended by ethnic humor, one ought to be honored. It's not an attack. Indeed, it means you won't be attacked. Notice that this is a different type of ethical argument. The others we've looked at were utilitarian arguments. This one is a care-based argument. Ethnic jokes are acts of care. They're signals that we're related, that I'll look out for you, or at least not oppress you, because you are part of us. And so we have one argument that ethnic jokes ought never be told, three very different arguments that ethnic jokes are always morally allowable to tell, and now we'll look at the three arguments that these jokes are only sometimes allowable. If you want to hold the nuanced view, that it depends, then you need to be clear about the nuance. Exactly when and by whom may these jokes be told, and why are those the conditions? That's the burden that must be accepted by advocates of the middle ground position. The first of these context-based positions is probably the most widely held view outside the academic world. If you ask most people when it's acceptable to tell an ethnic joke about a particular group, the answer will almost universally be only if you are a member of that group. Only Jews can tell Jewish jokes. Only Irish can tell Irish jokes. Only blondes can tell blonde jokes, whether they understand them or not. We would call this the group identity view. You can only make jokes about a group that is part of your own identity. The reasoning here is a combination of the two views we've already examined. On the one hand, jokes have content, and that content can cause harm. When we're made fun of, it can lead to stereotyping and thereby to oppression. Jokes can hurt, especially when told in a mean-spirited way. This means that those outside the group cannot tell the jokes because it embeds bigotry in the wider community, and the telling of the joke itself serves as a signal of the continuance of that bigotry. You may or may not hold the bigoted view, but that you are perpetuating the stereotype makes you an agent of the oppression. But the dynamic is different within the group. We know we're not going to hurt ourselves. If you're in the group and I'm in the group, then we're related. We know that we're oppressed, and we're joined together to protect ourselves from them. When you tell a joke about our group to me, I know you don't believe in the stereotype. I know you're not trying to bring us down. I know you only have the best interests of our group at heart. So when someone inside the group tells a joke about our group, it leads to an increased sense of coherence. It's like a secret handshake. You're doing something that only we are allowed to do, and that makes us more us than we were. Notice what we have here. The first use of a different foundation for an ethics of ethnic jokes. This view is a rights-based position. Membership in a particular community brings with it the exclusive right to make jokes about that group. Only group members have it, and it cannot be sold or traded away. This exclusivity strikes some as far too strict. Surely there are some groups we can joke about other than our own, but which ones? A second version of the sometimes position is one that you find very popular amongst millennials. The view agrees with the group identity position that jokes from those outside the group can be harmful to those inside the group. Jokes made at the expense of group X by people from group Y can lead to the collective degradation of group X. The group identity view takes this to mean that no one from group Y should ever make jokes that have group X as the butt of the joke because it's never morally good to cause unnecessary harm. It's a violation of group X's rights. But the millennials' position is that some groups deserve to be harmed. We live in a society in which there's an uneven distribution of social power, and those who have the power do not have it because they deserve it. Indeed, sometimes those with the most power have gotten it through immoral means and perpetuate that power through oppressive social structures. As such, the harm to these groups occupying higher rungs on the ladder than they deserve is not problematic harm. Rather, it's a leveling of the playing fields, to mix metaphors. Social justice can be served by knocking certain people down a peg or two. If you have an immorally inflated social position, then harm that leads to your ending up down here with the rest of us is morally justified harm. As such, the line goes, it is morally acceptable to punch up. That is, to make jokes about those with more power, wealth, and control than your group. But it is never acceptable to punch down. That is, to make a joke at the expense of those who have less power, wealth, and control than your group. Punching up is striking a blow for social justice and equality. Punching down is a form of bullying. On this view, my jokes about blondes would be perfectly fine, because we do know that having blonde hair is seen as desirable in this culture, and people with blonde hair are deemed more attractive and thereby receive undeserved advantages. They're more likely to get hired, more likely to get promoted, more likely to get the benefit of the doubt, more likely to get dates. It turns out that the old saying is true. Blondes really do have more fun. As such, joking about them levels the playing field. Again, this is an argument from a rights-based perspective on ethics. Belonging to a given group endows one with certain rights. The less social capital you inherit by being a part of the group you're in, the greater your rights to make jokes. Those at the bottom have joke-making rights that are denied to those at the top. Again, these are rights that are acquired by identity and are not transferable. However, in the event of social change, say, if one group becomes more or less powerful within the social structure, everyone's rights to joke about others change accordingly. The final position in this contextual view, where the moral permissibility of telling a given ethnic joke depends upon circumstances, is what we can call the aesthetic position. The idea here is that there's not necessarily any prohibition on who can tell a joke about whom. But unlike the anytime, anywhere view that most comedians want, there are prohibitions. there's a line over which a joke becomes morally problematic. If a joke is offensive, then it's over the line. Any joke about an ethnic group is potentially offensive, and so it's probably over the line. At this point, the view sounds a lot like the universal prohibition view that ethnic jokes are never acceptable to tell. But, and this is the central feature of this view, there is a get-out-of-jail-free card. An offensive joke that would otherwise be morally out of bounds becomes morally acceptable if it's funny. Funny ethnic jokes get an ethical pass. The idea is that when someone tells an ethnic joke, we wonder whether the subtext of that joke is hate-filled bigotry. Is the reason the person told that joke invoking that stereotype because he believes the stereotype and wants me to believe it also so we can oppress that group? The political identity view, which only allows people in the group to tell jokes about their own group, solves this problem by making a blanket prohibition for those not in the group. This is a less restrictive line. We need to figure out whether the joke teller is telling the joke because he buys the stereotype. But there's a second reason he might be telling the joke. It's the reason one usually tells a joke, because it's a good joke. If the joke is indeed a good joke, then the reasonable inference is that the person told it because it's a good joke. But if it's a bad joke, why would he tell me that joke? The reasonable inference is that he told it because he accepts the racist stereotype contained within it. Comedians often buy this view and hold that the more offensive the joke is, the funnier it has to be for you to be able to get away with it. You can make jokes about Hitler and the Holocaust, some Jewish comics argue, but boy, oh boy, it better be an amazing joke. When you make a joke that could touch a nerve in a group, the joke has to deliver. If not, you are morally responsible for its content. On this view, telling an ethnic joke is a risk. If the joke lands, if people get it and find it funny, then you're off the hook morally. But if the joke bombs, you are now responsible morally for the ethical failure. So, the sometimes line is not drawn at group membership, but at artistic success. So, we've seen that with respect to ethnic jokes, there are three possible stances. Never allowable, always allowable, and sometimes allowable. There are thoughtful arguments for each one. Which one should we accept? How do I go about determining if you should tell the one about Pope John Paul II, Tiger Woods, and Charlie Sheen walking in a bar where Charlie Sheen says to Tiger Woods, "Hey, the last time we saw a poll that famous, there were two..." Never mind. Perhaps we should stick to chicken jokes.
Lecture 19. Comic Moralism.
So, Steve, really sorry to have to do this to you, but we've been receiving some complaints about some of the jokes in your lectures.
Complaints?
Yeah. Some of the jokes just aren't appropriate, and we've been receiving letters.
Letters? From people watching these videos?
Yeah.
But we're making them. We aren't done filming them yet. They haven't been released.
Well, you know, our customers are an advanced group. What can I say?
Are they psychic?
Some of them, but the thing is, we're under pressure from the old man upstairs to vet your jokes now. So let's see. Let's hear what jokes you're planning to use in this lecture.
So this traveling salesman's car breaks down in the middle. How many Catholic priests is it?
Oh, no.
Knock, knock?
Nope.
This is going to be one short lecture. In the last lecture, we examined the morality of telling ethnic jokes. One of the positions, the aesthetic view, argued that an ethnic joke was morally acceptable if it was funny. If the joke was received well by the audience, then the reason for telling it would be assumed to be the artistic merit of the joke. But If the joke was not funny, then the teller's motivation for telling it would be suspect. Why would you tell an unfunny joke that involved a stereotype? It couldn't have been to be funny because it wasn't. So the motivation must have been bigoted. You, bad joke teller, are a bad person. So there are some philosophers who argue that the morality of telling a joke depends on the funniness of the joke. Other philosophers have thought about the converse question. Does the funniness of a joke depend upon its morality? Is a joke more or less funny if it's morally problematic? This is what philosophers call the question of comic moralism. As one would expect, there are three stances on the question of comic moralism. Comic moralists contend that if a joke is immoral, then that fact diminishes the funniness of the joke. Another group of philosophers, called comic immoralists, disagree completely. They contend that the immorality increases the funniness of a joke. And the third view argues that the two factors are completely independent. The moral implications of a joke have absolutely no effect on the funniness of the joke. Funniness is a function of technical aspects of writing a joke and is independent of the meaning of the content of the joke. Philosophers who support this view are called comic amoralists. We will examine all three of these positions and the arguments for and against each in detail. Both the comic moralist and the comic immoralist agree in the first place that we can pass moral judgment on the content of a joke. While they disagree on the effect that judgment has on the funniness of the joke, they do agree that we can label jokes with an ethical score. A positive ethical score would mean that telling a given joke is a morally good act. A negative moral score would mean that telling a given joke would be a morally bad act. The comic moralists and immoralists agree that we could score jokes in this way, and will even agree on what the scores of the jokes should be. The two would also agree that we could give jokes a second score, a funniness score. Again, they would agree not only on the possibility of the score, but at least in principle on what that score should be. Where they differ is in the relation between the two scores. The comic moralist is going to contend that a negative moral score leads to a lower funniness score. A comic immoralist would argue that a negative score leads to a higher funniness score. And the comic amoralist believes that the two scores are completely independent of one another. Note that this debate is only about what happens in the case of a negative moral score. No one is contending that a positive moral score increases or decreases the funniness score. A righteous joke does not necessarily mean a funny joke. No one is holding that to be the case. Now, comics have long recognized an interesting phenomenon concerning jokes with positive moral scores. Late-night talk show host and former Saturday Night Live star and writer Seth Meyers has coined the term clapter for a common audience reaction to jokes with a positive moral score. Audiences will register their moral but not comedic approval of the content of a joke by applauding instead of laughing. Clapter is a positive response from the audience, but it's a positive response to the positive moral content of the joke, not to the positive funniness of the joke. Despite the positivity of the response, comedians don't like clapter. It means that they've connected with the audience in a political sense, but not in the humorous way they were aiming for. Positivity of the moral score on any view does not imply positivity on the funniness score. But what about a negative moral score? Comic moralists contend that this necessitates a decrease in the funniness score. This does not mean that the joke cannot be recognized as having technical virtues. It may be seen as a well-constructed joke, as a well-delivered joke, as a well-worded joke. But the immoral content of the joke undermines the funniness of it, decreasing its score, possibly necessitating that it has a negative funniness score. Immoral jokes just are not funny. Immoral jokes cannot and should not be funny. One significant philosopher who has adopted this view is Ronald D'Souza in his book, The Rationality of Emotion. That title is the key to his view. Philosophers have long taken what seems like the common sense view that there's a distinction to be drawn between reason and emotion. We often think of ourselves as having to choose between what we think and what we feel, between rational interests and passionate desires. As children, we're often told that there's a difference between wanting and needing. Yes, the chocolate tastes better than the broccoli, but we know we should eat the broccoli and not the chocolate, even if we don't want to. But D'Souza argues that in many cases, this distinction is inappropriate. Some emotions, mirth among them, are cognitive emotions, rational emotions, emotions that we experience for a reason. We may be right or wrong, justified or unjustified, when experiencing a cognitive emotion in a given context. Consider, for example, moral disgust. We need to separate moral disgust from plain old garden variety disgust. The term disgust involves the prefix dis, meaning not, and gust, which means taste. Literally, to say that something is disgusting is to say that it's not to our taste, something we would not want to put in our mouths. We may have to choose between chocolate and broccoli for a reason. We certainly will not eat them together. Chocolate-covered broccoli? Now that's disgusting. In other words, it's not something we want to eat. We find something disgusting in the usual sense if we experience a sort of revulsion to the thought of doing it. Television reality programs like Fear Factor thrive on this sort of thing. Let's offer a contestant a lot of money to do something all the people watching find disgusting and see if they'll agree to try. And if they're able to do it for as long as they need to, we watch the person and think, ew, I would never do that. We get an odd feeling in our stomach, almost a nauseous feeling just seeing or thinking about it. That disgust can be taken even farther to another related emotion, moral disgust. We find an action morally disgusting if it's something that we experience an emotional revulsion to because of its immorality. This is not a mere bodily response, but a cognitive one. There's a reason we find certain acts morally disgusting. We can explain it. We can make clear why the act is counter to the way we ought to act. And we deem the revulsion, the disgust, legitimate if the explanation holds. If someone argues that a given act is morally disgusting, but we can show that there's nothing morally wrong with it, then the person's claim is false. The person may find it disgusting in the ordinary sense, but it's not morally disgusting. Moral disgust is a cognitive emotion. It's an emotion for which we have rational reasons. D'Souza argues that mirth is another emotion like this. We have reasons for finding things funny. We can explain why we find something funny, and if those reasons do not hold, then it's really not funny. Some may argue that mirth, that is, laughter at a joke, is something that just happens to us. But D'Souza contends that this is not true at all. When we allow ourselves to find something funny, we make a voluntary choice. To find something funny is an attitudinal endorsement. We can, and often do, choose not to laugh at something we find inappropriate. We will register our disapproval how? By saying sternly to someone else, "That is not funny." When we say this, we're telling the person not only to stop laughing, but that laughing is a morally problematic choice. We would never say to someone who fell off a ladder to stop falling. They can't help it. But we will say to someone who finds something inappropriate funny to stop laughing because they can help that. The mirth they're displaying is a choice, and making that choice sends a social signal. If we're in a group and someone makes an immoral joke, say a derogatory joke about Jews, and people laugh, that laughter is meaningful. What that laughter does is display tacit or perhaps explicit agreement with the content of the joke. if someone told the old joke, what's the ultimate Jewish dilemma? Bacon on sale. And people laugh. To laugh is to signal two things. First, that you agree with the presupposition. In this case, laughing means that you believe that Jews are cheap. If you didn't believe it, D'Souza asks us, why would you have found it funny? Consider an alternate version of the joke. What's the ultimate Jewish dilemma? Should I eat both of the Twinkies that come in a pack? That's not at all funny. Why? Because you don't believe that Jews worry about Twinkies or in general eat too much. The first joke would only be funny if it was fundamentally different from the second joke. And the only difference would be if you believe the presupposition of the first joke but not the second. Only if you believe the stereotype of the cheap Jew would you find the first joke funny. And laughing at it in public not only says that you believe this, but that you endorse the view. To laugh at an immoral joke is to say to those around you that it's not, in fact, immoral. You're saying that it's fine to believe these things and others should join you in celebrating the truth of the stereotype. Because, you know, that's how those people really are. But that's an immoral act in itself. To encourage other people to believe stereotypes about an oppressed group is to set the stage for further oppression. Telling immoral jokes and laughing at them, the comic moralist argues, are both immoral acts. Immoral jokes are not funny, and allowing yourself to laugh at them, to hold them to be funny, is to put yourself on the wrong side of morality. The comic immoralist takes a completely different approach. The comic immoralists often start from a theoretical position. Let us think back to our discussions about humor theory. Humor is defined by some sort of mechanism that's held to be necessary and sufficient to generate comic amusement. It might be incongruity, it might be playfulness, it might be a release of cognitive energy, but there is some factor that's employed in creating humor. The different stripes of comic immoralists correspond to the different approaches to humor. But what they all share is the view that the immorality of a joke can be an operative factor in triggering the mechanism that causes humor. The easiest place to see this is with Freud's version of relief theory. For Freud, there's always a battle in the subconscious. The id has urges and desires that the superego will not allow to rise to the level of conscious thought. There's a war in the hidden part of the mind. The suppression of the desires requires increasing amounts of mental energy. The pressure builds and builds. The mind will crack, giving rise to neurotic behaviors or a complete breakdown if something's not done. The id needs to express itself. The mind needs to relieve the pressure. The steam must be released. Along comes the immoral joke, the tendentious joke, the ethnic or dirty joke. It's mere words, not action. It's not doing. It's only saying. As such, the superego allows it out. The superego is at the front door guarding against action, while the joke slips out unnoticed through the back door of language. The tendentious joke allows us to malign or titillate without actually having done anything. It's the tendentiousness of the joke, the immorality of the joke, according to Freud, which allows it to do its job. The joke gives rise to the appropriate release of mental energy. The laughter, the mirth, is a direct result of the joke's being immoral. If it were not immoral, it wouldn't release the pressure. It would not be the joke it is, and it wouldn't be funny. Here we see a straightforward comic immoralism tied to a specific account of the nature of humor. To buy this line, you also have to buy relief theory. But we can generate other brands of comic immoralism when we consider other humor theories. Consider the view most contemporary philosophers of humor take to be the correct view, incongruity theory. According to incongruity theory, an act of humor must involve the appreciation or resolution of an incongruity, of things that do not fit together. Jokes require brevity. Crafting a joke requires that the joke be tight, that there not be unnecessary elements. You give a setup that leads a person to think in one way, and then, bam, hit them with the punchline that makes them completely change how they have to think. You need to get people to form in their minds a complete joke world based on a short, incomplete description that you provide in as few words as possible. This means that they'll have to mentally fill in many of the gaps themselves. Consider this perfectly clean joke.
Two sheep are in a field, and one of them says, "I wonder if it's going to rain today." And then a dog walks past, and he says, "No, they're calling for clear skies this afternoon." And the first sheep looks at the second sheep and says, "Oh my God, a talking dog."
The reason this joke is funny, or at least is supposed to be, is that when you hear the setup that one sheep is speaking to the other sheep, you assume that the rules of this joke world are such that animals have the ability to speak. But then in the punchline, you realize that you were only instructed to suppose that sheep can speak. You filled in that all animals are capable of human speech yourself. In telling jokes, we can rely on the fact that the human mind, in creating the fictional, hypothetical joke world, will fill in gaps and do so in predictable ways. This predictability is essential. When we deliver the setup, we need our audience's mind to put a very particular, very complete joke world in place. We will then introduce a specific confounding element that does not fit into the mental, hypothetical joke world we know they've created. Ultimately, they will realize that they need to reconstruct this joke world to fit in this new confounding information. And the appreciation of the incongruity between the original and the final world is what they will laugh at. What are the rules that can guarantee we know the created world in these other people's minds? Some of those will be rules of morality. We suppose in our social engagements that people we're friendly with will obey moral precepts. There are social mores we just expect will be followed. Walk up on someone and introduce yourself by name and extend your hand. You expect that the person will reach out and cordially shake your hand. If the person does not, just leaves you hanging there, you're shocked. This is an expectation of behavior based on both cultural norms and ethical mores. I was once discussing the difference between cultural norms and ethical mores in a class when a student raised his hand and said, "Excuse me, Steve, but what is a more?" I looked him in the eye and replied, "When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's a more." This is a funny joke and completely true because there was an expectation that a teacher will address a request for information with a fact or explanation, not with a song lyric. Similarly, when the audience builds the joke world in their heads from the incomplete information of the setup, the gaps will be filled in with moral expectations of behavior. Jokes can use this expectation as a pivot upon which to turn. Shock humor, ethnic jokes, dirty jokes will often use the presupposition of a moral order in the constructed joke world as the basis for their incongruity. Anthony Jeselnik, Sarah Silverman, or Amy Schumer will tell jokes by giving what seems like an innocent setup and then finish it with a quite morally inappropriate follow-up. The humor is generated by the unexpected immorality of the comedian's punchline. Without the immorality, there's no joke. The comic immoralist, who's an incongruity theorist, will argue that it's precisely the immorality of the joke that's responsible for the incongruity. The immorality is what makes it funny. This is one place where we can go in the other direction, where we can get humor without immorality if we have primed the audience to expect it. If the joke world they create is one in which there's expectation of a violation, then we can create humor from the lack of one.
Knock, knock. Who's there? Fornication. Fornication who? Fornication like this. Black tie is optional.
The setup leads the audience to expect something sexual, but in the end, it's entirely other. This is not a completely clean joke, but it's not a dirty joke either. It's one that creates humor from the false expectation of titillation. So, we see from both the relief theory and the incongruity theory standpoints how it can be argued that the immorality of a joke enhances its funniness. We see an argument made from the play theory perspective as well. Consider the film The Aristocrats. This documentary shows dozens of professional comedians telling the same joke. A joke comics rarely tell on stage, but will tell amongst themselves. The joke itself is not terribly funny. A family goes into a talent agency saying they have an act. The agent says, "Let's see your act." The act involves various elements of immorality. In some tellings, sexual, in others, scatological, in others, just disgusting. At the end of the act, the agent asks what they call themselves, and the answer is, "The Aristocrats." The humor is based on the incongruity between the aristocratic label and the very unaristocratic nature of the act. But the humor is not in the usual place in this joke. It's not in the sudden shift of perspective from the punchline. Rather, it's in the playfulness of the comic telling it. The humor is in how far out, how absurd, how disgusting the teller is willing to be in setting up the punchline. The humor comes from the immorality of the playfulness of the teller. The humor of the joke, like a gross-out contest among 8-year-old boys, is to be found in how much the teller is willing to play. But some advocates of comic immorality realize that it can go too far and have sought a middle ground with the comic moralists. Yes, they say, it is possible to go too far, and in such cases, the immorality harms the funniness. Some immorality helps, but taking it too far over the line hurts. This is called moderate comic immoralism, or comic pluralism, and has its intellectual foundations in this play-based picture. The idea is that humor requires a playful stance. We can play about the edges of morality, flouting the rules slightly in a playful manner. But if we take a giant step beyond the boundary, willingly and brazenly, then we put ourselves in a place where we ought to be morally uncomfortable. This moral discomfort ought to shock us away from lighthearted playfulness, making humor impossible. We can, for example, make fun of Adolf Hitler, as Mel Brooks and Lenny Bruce did. Do it well and it's funny. But that's different from making fun of the mass killings in the Holocaust. After Roseanne Barr tried to be funny while butchering the national anthem at a baseball game and was roundly booed for it, she appeared on a sketch on Saturday Night Live, where she was a contestant on a game show called Comedy Killers. Based on Jeopardy, it had categories of topics that one should not joke about because they're just too serious. In an upcoming lecture, we'll examine the question of whether there are sacred cows, that is, topics, people, or entities that should be off limits to all joking. But for our purposes here, we need only consider that some cases may be so over the line that even if you admit that some immorality can enhance funniness, there are cases where we ought to be morally disgusted, even the mention of an action or event which makes it unavailable for play. So, on one extreme, we have the comic moralists, who contend that morally problematic content impedes funniness. We have comic immoralists, who hold that immoral content enhances funniness. We have comic pluralists, who say it can do both depending upon the amount and type of immorality. The last group is the comic amoralists. They hold the view that the moral content of a joke is irrelevant to its funniness. The argument here is that what makes a joke funny is not its content, but its structure. The content of the joke is only relevant in that it's used for psychological priming. The teller of a joke knows what mental associations accompany a given topic, group, or individual. These are then employed not to say anything about the topic, group, or individual, but rather to set up expectations in the mind of the listener in a predetermined way. That then allows the mind of the listener